Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I'm joined in the studio by AC Valdez, who is our senior producer and who helped us make this transition 1 year ago to become a one-hour-long show. We did it, AC!
We did it!
Happy one-year anniversary birthday.
Oh, that's so touching, Maria.
That was like too many words. Anyway, listen, so for this one-year anniversary, you came up with the idea of having the Latino USA producers pick out their favorite pieces from the year, and we'll talk about them. And your favorite piece was?
Well, my favorite piece that I produced, really, was the piece on being the worst Latino.
What do you mean the worst Latino? There are probably people who didn't hear that piece, so what are you talking about?
The worst Latino. I mean, I really wanted to create a piece that spoke to the insecurity of being, maybe you're biracial like I am, maybe you're someone who doesn't eat chile like Nancy Trujillo, who some of you know makes it all happen. Maybe you are Cuban, but you never spoke Spanish in your life and you feel some amount of shame about that. That's what I wanted to speak to in that piece.
Now, you decided that you wanted to interview our staff members. It was a way of you getting to know them better when you first started. But what was it that was kind of revealed to you when you talked to the staff of Latino USA feeling that they were the worst Latino?
I mean, I was a little shocked to realize the insecurity that was there from, you know, in the public radio world, we're the most Latino program on the air. We have been for 20 years. Nobody's secure about that. Not even here where, like, it's kind of like, you know, we're as Latino as we want to be. Are we? I don't know.
We haven't reached that holy grail yet of being the worst or the best Latino. Anyway, here it is, the worst Latino.
I was talking about spicy food, which I love, with our office manager, Nancy Trujillo. Nancy, why are you the worst Latina?
You know what? I'm not even the worst Latina. I'm the worst Mexican. So my mother would tell me, if you don't eat chile, you're not Mexican. So I would tell her, fine, I won't be Mexican. I won't eat it.
Conversations like this, BuzzFeed lists, other everyday situations, they can feed into stereotypes and create this creeping insecurity. The feeling that you're the worst Latino, if not on the planet, then at least in the room. Don't get me wrong, we all want to be authentic, but my mom didn't chase me with a chancleta, I don't aspire to own a lowrider, hell, I grew up in Northern Virginia, not East LA. So I decided to talk with a bunch of our staff about this kind of thing.
Is that the only bad Latina thing you got going on?
I mean, I also don't want kids, and when we were making a list earlier of, you know, why were we the worst Latinos and...
Y'all were making a list?
Well, Maya was having difficulties with figuring out, so Brenda said, oh, do you want kids? And I was like, I don't want kids. So, I mean, I guess I assume, you know, I'm also Mexican with tons and tons and tons of cousins.
You just said you weren't Mexican.
Yeah. See, it's a battle. It's a battle back and forth. But I don't want kids of my own.
I feel like a lot of worst Latino feelings have to do with food. I'm not sure why, but it seems to be a lot of them.
My name is Brenda Patricia Salinas Páez.
Spice.
Páez.
Páez.
Brenda Patricia Salinas Páez. I'm the worst Latina because I do not like flan.
Why don't you like flan?
It's just such a waste of a dessert opportunity. You've never heard this. Nobody has ever said, I had the best flan last night. Even when you get the best flan ever, you still wish you'd ordered the chocolate cake.
Sometimes the stereotypes are positive. We're great dancers. We're passionate lovers. We love our families. But sometimes... not so much.
I am Maya Camila Sanchez Acero.
Stereotypes about Colombians. Don't assume that all Colombians are in the drug trade. Well, that's not a thing that people... Is that... Do people still think that?
What else did Google yield about Colombians?
Well, the best thing I think that I saw about, like, specifically Latina women is that there's the two sort of contradictory stereotypes that they have about how... women are, like, sexy, sensual, like, curvaceous, but they're also, like, virginal and, like, religious and...
Would you describe yourself as both?
No, I would not describe myself as either. So, there you go. That's how I'm the worst Latina. I'm not religious, nor am I sensual.
Beyond stereotypes, for modern-day Latinos, there's also a lot of pressure... to know your background, to know your history.
Mi nombre es Marea Aurora Chaveco Torrado. like, we're the white folks from the island, right? My family's from Cuba. They never mixed. We were like the bad folks on the island that got out of Dodge when it got tough. I knew more about Broadway shows and the Brat Pack and all the movies, and everything I was ever exposed to was really American. Jose Martí, there's a book on my shelf. You know. You know, I remember very vividly coming back from school one day with some classmates, and everyone thought I was white, and my mother's even whiter than me physically. They just were like, what is that you guys are talking?
I think this is something I worry about the most. My Spanish is pretty terrible, even if my Espanglish is pretty good. I'm whiter than most people think of when they think of Mexicans, because I'm mixed. But I still grew up with a close friend who called me super spick. Yeah. All of this makes it apparent to me that as this country becomes not just more Latino, but more multiracial, as worlds merge and intersect, being the worst Latino is kind of a silly thing to be self-conscious about. No, Maria?
I do think it's a silly thing to be self-conscious about. But here's the thing, AC. Almost every Latino I meet has something to say, well, but, you know, my Spanish isn't great, or I didn't grow up in California, or, you know, they have this kind of like, there's something wrong with me. So is it just Latinos who have this obsession of, am I Latino enough? Am I a good enough Latino?
I mean, you've heard the expression Oreo in the Black community. It's not something complimentary. It's, you know, black on the outside, white on the inside. You've heard the expression coconut, I think, made it onto Orange is the New Black. You remember that?
So do you think the conversation about, you know, are there better Latinos, worse Latinos? Do you think this conversation has got to kind of take off on a national level before we can kind of move forward and everybody says, you know what, I'm the Latino that I am, y se acabó?
Yeah, that's why I brought it up. So I'm hoping that some of our listeners out there send us a tweet at LatinoUSA. Tell us, what's been your worst Latino moment? What's been your best Latino moment?
All right, listeners, if you think you're the world's worst Latino, send us a tweet. Or if you think you're the best Latino, send us a tweet at LatinoUSA. AC, thanks so much for joining us. AC Valdez is our senior producer of LatinoUSA. Joining me now in the studio is our newest producer, Antonia Cerejido. Hey, Antonia.
Hi, Maria.
So, Antonia, one of your favorite pieces from our Year of Ours was a piece about somebody who's a voiceover artist.
So Silvia Villagrán is a voice artist who works both in English and in Spanish. I like movies, and I, in general, was very curious about this job. I mean, her job is to go into an office every day and talk.
Talk to me a little bit about why you chose a piece that was from our Sabiduría, our Words of Wisdom Ender show.
Well, I think that the Sabiduría really sets a tone in all of our episodes. I really like that it's this one recurring thread. And she's very good at talking about both her own struggle, but also how culture affected her experience. We're looking at a group of people who are individuals and also live within a bigger context. And in Sabiduría every week, it's the perfect opportunity for people to talk about that dynamic. And I think for me as a young journalist, just starting out in this job, for instance, I feel like I get Sabiduría every day from you and from other producers.
Truth is that there was also like a very special thing that happened when you spoke with Silvia Villagrán.
Yeah, Silvia, I asked her if she would say my name in different intonations.
You're listening to Antonia Cerejido on Latino USA. You're listening to Antonia Cerejido on Latino USA. You're listening to Antonia Cerejido on Latino USA.
That was so cool. That was awesome.
Let's take a listen now to the piece about Silvia Villagrán, which was one of our Sabiduría, or our Words of Wisdom pieces.
Latin America's sexiest guilty pleasure is now on Mundos.
She talked to us about what it takes to be a bilingual voice actor.
I've got an agent, but they were only sending me out on stuff in Spanish. I cornered them and I said, so I really want to know, why are you not sending me out on stuff? You know, because I'm ready. I'm willing to do it. And he goes, you know, you don't have anything special going on with your voice, so I can't really sell you. I could really let that affect me. Or, which was what I did, I got pissed. And I was like, you're not going to tell me that I don't have anything special going on with my voice after A, I have work, and B, you're taking 10% of it. So I fired him, and I went looking for an agent. I went to my current agent, Sutton Barthavanari, SBV. And we came to the conclusion that maybe it would be good to change my name. They kept saying that maybe the casting directors or clients, when they hear my slate, Sylvia Villagran, they'd go, they wouldn't maybe not want to hire me. So I changed my name to Sylvia Granville. I actually started getting callbacks. I got a couple jobs. And then 1999 happened. And it was J-Lo and Ricky Martin and Selma Hayek. And all of a sudden it became super sexy, right? To be Latina. And so my agent and I said, okay, let's change it back. So now I was Sylvia Villagran. And all of a sudden now I began to book. I hear this all the time. People have told me that I have a really great voice and I want to get into voiceovers. It takes a lot more than your voice.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And joining me now in the studio is Latino USA producer Camilo Vargas, who is going to talk about one of his favorite pieces from the past year, one that he produced. It's called Inventing Hispanics. And Camilo, I'm really glad you're here because I really love this piece. Tell our listeners a little bit about why you love this piece and what it's about.
Well, the original idea came about when Marlon Bishop started producing the History of the United States episode. And Marlon had this idea of asking where the term Hispanic actually comes from. And he produced the interview with you, and I jumped at the idea of actually doing the mix and the edit for the piece. Because it's the kind of reporting that I want to do. I want to do that kind of like explanation reporting, kind of telling people where identities and ideas and concepts and histories, you know, and narratives actually come from.
It's also a little bit about your own story because you have this interesting relationship to being quote unquote Hispanic or Latino because you're born and raised in Colombia.
Exactly. And this idea of being Hispanic or being Latino, or for the first time being aware that, you know, I'm not the dominant group, or I'm not the majority, or I'm not the mainstream. You know, I'm basically kind of discovering this whole identity of being Hispanic. So this was an experience of, you know, reporting on why we call ourselves Hispanics here in the United States and what purpose that serves. And so it was a great interview. You connected with Professor Mora very deeply. And towards the end of the piece, the professor actually gets up close and personal. I guess it's the Maria touch.
All right, let's take a listen to the piece.
Hola, soy Chichi Rodriguez. Todavía hay tiempo para devolver el cuestionario del censo del 80. Hágalo hoy. Es muy importante.
That's legendary golfer Juan Chichi Rodriguez in a 1980s commercial for the Spanish International Network, the channel that would later become Univision. He's inviting Hispanics to submit their census forms for the first time ever, choosing the Hispanic category. Cristina Mora is a sociology professor who studied the history of the term Hispanic. Cristina, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you for having me.
So right now, we essentially take for granted in our country that there is a group of people that are labeled and called Hispanics. But this notion of a large group of people, all of them Spanish-speaking, all under one umbrella, was not the way Hispanics were thought of for many, many years. So what were we before we became Hispanics?
Before these ideas about us coming together were even there, you know, we were all our separate, distinct nationalities. I mean, you know, if we look at America in the 1960s, Mexican Americans almost had a different world and a different set of issues and needs than those that Puerto Ricans might have had in the Northeast.
So who is responsible, if you had to say, Is there an institution? Was there a plan essentially in this notion of creating the Hispanic identity?
I think the National Council La Raza was one of the first groups to help lobby the Census Bureau to start thinking about changing the way it classified these groups. And it was also one of the lead organizations taking a role in bringing Puerto Ricans and Mexican Americans together to hammer out a Hispanic agenda.
And what role does the Census Bureau play?
For decades, up until about 1970, they had mainly categorized Mexican-Americans and Puerto Ricans as simply white. And this was incredibly frustrating for Chicano activists. Whenever they would argue that they needed money for job training programs, they never really had the data to show the federal government. And so as the Bureau considered what kind of category they would create, they started to imagine a broad Hispanic category with subcategories where one could identify themselves as Hispanic, but also as Mexican or Puerto Rican or Cuban, etc.
The other big player was the media. We're going to play another clip from a 1990s Univision commercial, courtesy of their archive.
Participar en el censo es un paso importante para obtener la representación y los servicios que necesita nuestra comunidad hispana.
What role did Univision have in creating the Hispanic / Latino identity?
Over time, as Spanish language television begins to grow, especially throughout the 1980s, they begin to attach sounds, images, and narratives to this idea about what a Hispanic is.
And there were also commercial interests, marketing interests. So what role did marketing and advertising play in creating this Hispanic / Latino identity?
After 1980, the Census Bureau creates some of the first reports on now Hispanics in America. Whereas activist groups might use the income figures to show Washington that Hispanics had higher rates of poverty, for example, Univision executives would use those exact income figures and show General Mills or McDonald's and say, look, this is Hispanic buying power.
So overall, Cristina, would you say that we've gained something from becoming this huge pan-Latino Hispanic category?
When you have a sense of a powerful community, you can create lots of things. You can create organizations that help to reproduce the notion of a community. So, for example, my daughter was born last year, and on her birth certificate, it says that she's Hispanic. When the day comes that I'll enroll her in school, all her school forms will say that she's Hispanic. For all intents and purposes, my daughter might see herself the rest of her life as a Hispanic because it's all around her and it's connected to all kinds of opportunities now.
Your daughter might also just see herself as an American who doesn't have to label herself as a Hispanic because, you know, soon she won't be the quote-unquote minority.
I think, though, as long as Latinos still suffer from many social disadvantages as a group, there'll still be a fight to be had and there'll still be a way of using the category for social justice or civil rights.
Cristina, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria. It's been a pleasure.
Cristina Mora is a sociology professor at UC Berkeley. She's the author of Making Hispanics: How Activists, Bureaucrats, and the Media Constructed a New America. Okay, Camilo, you are in the studio with us one more time because another one of your favorite pieces, again, stems from real life experience, but you like to put that in the context of journalism. This was the case with your piece, Flirty Racism, right? So what's this piece about and where did the idea come from?
One of my first experiences with what I would call actual racism was, when a guy walked up to me at a bar and basically said, you know, you're the cutest Mexican I've ever seen, as if though there were no such thing as cute Mexicans. And I found it racist and weird, and I kind of started wondering, you know, how common this is. And another one of our producers, Daisy Rosario, told me, you know, this is fairly common when you're a person of color, and especially a woman of color. And we went out to the streets of New York and actually, you know, we were talking to people, mostly women of color, but also some men, about the ways that they are approached. And what we discovered is that there is no there are no rules and there is no etiquette for this, what you called multi-culti dating. And sometimes, you know, the line between racism, exoticization, and flattery can be very, very elusive.
It's not the kind of thing you often hear people talking about, at least not on public media, public radio. So there was a lot of response to it. What happened?
Well, the piece was picked up by Upworthy, I think because of the identity angle. And we got a lot of great responses from people telling us, you know, what flirty racism was like for them. And then we had two specific responses from two listeners. The first one basically asked us, you know, why we're not talking about, you know, flirty racism against white women. And on the other hand, we had a black listener who actually told us, you know, you might be trivializing racism by talking about it in these terms. So what we tried to do with this piece was, yes, give it a happy tone. We wanted to have fun with it because the people that were talking to us were actually very empowered. The women that were talking to us were actually, you know, spoke from a place of indignation.
Here you go. Flirty racism on Latino USA.
You're Mexican? But you're so pretty.
You don't act Latina.
Ooh, Latina. Spicy.
Do these sound familiar? They didn't to me at first, until this happened. I was standing outside a club in New York City, and a middle-aged white guy walks up to me, and he says, "You're the cutest Mexican I've ever seen." Now, I'm not Mexican, and it was kind of weird that he was surprised to actually see a cute Mexican guy. And then he said, "We should get out of here before the cops get here because, you know, Mexicans and the cops." Now, what does that even mean? I come from South America where most people actually look like me. So I had never experienced something so offensive and creepy at the same time. A few weeks later, I'm going through my Facebook feed and I see an article on Vice magazine. Calling me a terrorist is not flirting. So I invited the author, Rula Al-Nasrawi, to help me make sense of this on our show. Rula, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me, you guys.
So tell me a little bit what experiences you had that led you to write this piece on flirty racism.
A couple years back, I was at a burger place with my best friend from home in California. And the guy that I'm talking to says that he's a veteran from Iraq and... because I had told him in conversation that I was from Iraq. So then he, you know, looks at me and says, "Well, you're, you know, I just got back from there and you're very attractive for an Iraqi woman."
Wow.
Yeah. So a little very awkward.
Yeah.
One of those things where I was like, does he know that that's not a compliment? It just puts you in this awkward position of like, did you only want to talk to me because I look different?
We knew very well we're not the only people that have gotten flirty racism. So we went out on the streets of New York City and we found the different types of flirty racism out there. Here are some of the women we met.
"You're a beautiful Spanish girl." And it's just like, so I'm not beautiful. I'm just a beautiful Spanish, in my Spanish culture.
We were just at a lounge and, you know, this guy approached us, both of us, and, "Oh, you know, we're beautiful for black women."
Not compliments, man. Then another pattern was full-blown exoticization and offensive generalization.
Like what they say when they approach me is, "Oh my God, you look like Lucy Liu." I'm like, I look nothing like Lucy Liu, but I'm glad you're aware of one Asian actress.
And then we even found men of color who also get fetishized by women.
"So there was a cougar. So I have this older lady. She's got to be in her 50s. She comes into my, you know, to my job. I work in like at a vitamin shop. So she says like she's into Hispanic men, and she just automatically, she would just tell everybody, all my customers, that I'm her boyfriend. So it was sort of uncomfortable, but I took it in stride."
And then just straight up caricatura.
"So they'll start with ni hao, and then when you ignore it, they say konnichiwa, and then they'll say, 'Well, does this work or does that work?' And they'll try multiple Asian languages and say, 'Well, I guess you don't speak any one of them.'"
Some of the people we talked to had their own suggestions for flirting etiquette.
"When you think stereotypical thoughts or racist thoughts, there's a line between immediately coming out with it versus keeping it to yourself until you reach an understanding, until you don't think them anymore and want to just come out with it.
I don't even say it.
I just think that I can be beautiful for who I am.
Yeah. You appreciate the way that I look. Right. Doesn't matter what color I am. I think it's just unnecessary.
As Rula points out, exoticization is offensive and it doesn't even make sense anymore.
Especially in the U.S., it's like this is a diverse country, and it shouldn't be as much of a thing. It's 2014, so to still be called exotic is like, where are you from?
Yeah. Rula, thank you so much for joining us here on Latino USA.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Ula Al-Nasrawi is a contributor at Vice, The Atlantic, and Galore magazines. And we want to hear your experiences with hashtag flirty racism. Tweet at us at LatinoUSA and tell us your story. Well, mis queridos listeners, I like to think of LatinoUSA as a place where women have a voice. Well, if not the voice, which is not to say that guys can't learn from this. So here's producer Michael Simon Johnson to tell us why one of his favorite pieces over the last year was a piece that had to do with women and stock photos.
Yeah.
What did you find so interesting about this piece?
It was enlightening. It was about how these stock photos that we see all the time are, it's not just that they're kind of insensitive to a certain extent, but also that they're just very silly and really out of touch. It sort of shows like, oh, look, women are so stressed. Look at how stressed they have, so much going. They have kids and then she's holding a baby and oh, she's got work and she's on the computer and her phone. And, oh, she's so stressed. And it's kind of presented like a joke as if stress isn't a real problem. I see those pictures and I feel like they are presented to have women look at them and say, oh, I know, it's so true. And I wonder if they even encourage women in a certain kind of way to feel like that level of stress is normal.
So here's our piece about stock photos and working women. Go get your computer and search working mom. So what do you see? A woman in a really bad pantsuit feeding a crying toddler in a kitchen while talking on a huge, like, brick-sized cell phone? A woman struggling to hold a baby in a briefcase? All right, now do a search for woman executive. Get the picture? It's a problem that Sheryl Sandberg wants to fix. She's partnering with Getty Images, the largest provider of these photos, to create a collection of photos that depict women in more empowering ways. Our favorite fashion blogger, Veronica Marche Miller, joins us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia to talk about why this is such a big deal. Veronica, welcome back to Latino USA.
Thanks for having me.
Look, I'm a mother of two. I know all about the juggling and the nursing while you're working and all that. But at the same time, those stock photos that you find, like in the past, it just looks so unrealistic and unappealing.
Oh, yeah. The stock photos that we're so used to seeing online, it almost feels like a cartoonist picked up a camera and decided to take a photograph of what he thought a working mom looked like. It's funny that you mentioned the mom who is juggling all sorts of things. There's also the stock photographs where they actually Photoshop extra arms onto a woman to show how much she's juggling and how stressed out she is.
How much do you think that they impact our perceptions of women?
I do think they can have an effect because these are the images, the stock photo images that newspapers, blogs, websites, they have to use these images because they can't afford to hire a photographer, professional models, or anything like that. So they just have to use this very limited availability of photos to try to get their point across. And oftentimes the images are to a detriment of that.
Mm. So not seeing ourselves portrayed accurately in the media, I don't know. I know of several thousand women of color, Latinas, who would be like, yeah, we are
never
accurately portrayed.
Absolutely. I was looking for like a black woman who maybe looked like a creative professional giving a presentation. And it became just laughable. It's always this black woman with her arms crossed in this black plain suit looking at you like, if you say anything wrong, I'm going to come for you. And that's not what I was looking for at all.
It's funny because I haven't done a search for that, but it's like, yeah, I've seen that image.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the one that permeates, that's the one that's across every stock site that you can look up.
So we talked to Adriana Gaspar. She created a very popular style Latino Tumblr. And this is what she had to say about this.
I really was just looking for a website that just focused on Latino people. And then I did not find one after doing some extensive researching, and I just decided if there wasn't one, then I would create one.
I mean, it is hopeful, right, that maybe this generation is saying, okay, look, we know it's hard to juggle, but you have got to find that moment of we're alive, it's a joyful time, we've got to make ourselves feel that way. And that's kind of a reflection of this generation, I guess I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think women, I can speak for myself, Black women in particular, are tired of being portrayed as not being happy. So I think seeing these women in these authentic situations and oftentimes just looking content is a big step.
Well, we're all about creating our own images and our own narratives. So thanks for helping us do that. You as well, Veronica. So we appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Veronica Marche Miller is a fashion blogger for XOJane.com. She joined us from the studios of WHYY in snowy Philadelphia. So a few months ago, we ran this really cool program all about the untold Latino history of the United States. And this episode included a story about Zorro. But last time I checked, Zorro is not a historical character. He's, in fact, a fictional character. So why Zorro?
Because, come on, who doesn't love Zorro?
Okay, that's our producer, Marlon Bishop, who put together that episode. Marlon, I love the piece about Zorro.
What was your relationship with Zorro?
I remember seeing him on television. I definitely remember him having really dark hair. And Zorro, you know, I mean, there was something Spanish about it. So I kind of got it, but I was a kid.
Exactly. And I had no idea. I mean, Zorro's everywhere in a certain sense. You know, you're a kid, there is an animated TV show. And I was a kid that was on, I don't remember when, the old TV shows would come on every now and then. But it never dawned on me that Zorro was supposed to depict a Californio or person who lived in colonial California during the Spanish and Mexican period. So that was kind of blew my mind a little bit. Did you ever realize that?
No, and that's why I love this piece, because it was suddenly like, wow, Zorro has this whole history. So what is the history of Zorro? And why are we always just limited to seeing him as this masked man when, in fact, there's so much more about him?
So we're going to hear about that in the piece that's coming up. But I basically came across a story in reading a book, and I found that Zorro was actually based on real-life characters. And not only that, these historical figures were actually figures of anti-American resistance during this whole colonial period. And I just love this idea that we thought we knew Zorro, but we don't really know Zorro. And there's some really deep layers going on in this story that are kind of wrapped up in this character.
All right. Well, let's hear the piece and check out those deep layers for ourselves. Thanks, Marlon.
You got it.
You've probably never realized it, but the first great American superhero was Latino.
Zorro, 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 Zorro.
Who wore a mask, wore black clothing, melted into the night, and had a fabulous black steed whose name was Tornado.
Out of the night when the full moon is bright.
That was Sandra Curtis, a Zorro expert. Zorro didn't have superpowers. He couldn't fly or shoot lasers from his eyes, but he was as quick as the wind. He was unbeatable in a sword fight. And, of course, had a way with the ladies.
And what should I say you're best at?
Well, I dance all known dances, and I yield to no one in the new world. As kissing ladies' hands, permit me.
Rather than having superpowers, he had super smarts. So he was able to outwit his adversaries rather than overpower them.
Señores,
it's Zorro! I will capture him, comandante!
Most certainly I have not come to surrender, said Señor Zorro. I am on business.
Business? Zorro, or the fox in English, was invented by Johnston McCulley, a pulp fiction writer from California. These passages come from his first Zorro story, The Curse of Capistrano, published in 1919.
4 days ago, senor, you brutally beat a native who had won your dislike. The affair happened on the road between here and the mission at San Gabriel.
He was a surly dog and got in my way. How does it concern you, my pretty highwayman?
I am the friend of the oppressed, senor, and I have come to punish you.
The Zorro story is set in Spanish colonial California. Zorro is the dashing alter ego of the meek Don Diego, son of the wealthiest landowner in the pueblo of Los Angeles.
Oh, please, please, it's only I. Has something happened?
Zorro's world is full of corrupt colonial officials and cruel military captains.
California is in my hands. I'm accountable to no one, is that clear?
No one!
They abuse their power, tormenting indigenous peasants and Catholic friars alike. When night falls, Diego dons his mask and goes on a one-man mission to set things right. But the colonial administration fears Zorro, so they try to turn the public against him by smearing him as a dangerous and murderous bandit. McCulley's story was turned into a hit silent film with Douglas Fairbanks in 1920 and went on to inspire dozens of remakes and TV series. But McCulley didn't pull Zorro out of thin air. The California bandido archetype he resembles had already been floating around for a while, born in the tumult around the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, when Yankees began streaming into California and squatting on Mexican-owned land.
What arose in the popular history, a number of characters who were trying, like Zorro, to defend the vulnerable.
We don't know for sure, but experts believe that Zorro was based on a famous outlaw named Joaquin Murrieta. Murrieta allegedly came to California from Mexico during the gold rush, but was prevented from seeking his fortune by California's foreign miners tax, which was designed to keep Hispanics off the gold fields. Unable to find work, Murrieta terrorized the highways of Northern California. Depending on who you talk to, he was either a hero of Mexican resistance or a common murderer. The only thing is, he might not have been a real person.
There was a popular sort of yellow journalist who started writing in the San Francisco paper about this character, and he probably created Joaquin Murrieta.
As the story goes, the governor put a ransom on Murrieta's head. After he was captured, his literal head was preserved in a bottle of brandy and exhibited around the state. The head eventually made its way to live behind a bar in a San Francisco saloon until it was destroyed in the earthquake of 1906.
It made for great journalism. The question is, was it real?
Another bandido that was undeniably real was Juan Cortina, a South Texas rancher turned fighter. One day in Brownsville, he saw a gringo sheriff giving a beating to one of his former employees. He shot the sheriff and fled. He went on to assemble a ragtag insurgent force that battled with the U.S. Army on and off for years. After being defeated, he spent the rest of his career rustling cattle and dodging the law. Throughout, he framed his actions as revenge for the unjust treatment of Tejanos by the Americans. Historical figures like Cortina provided a model for the Zorro story, but that was just the beginning. Zorro, in turn, went on to serve as a prototype for future superheroes. Think about Batman, another wealthy loner who dons a mask to fight for justice. Batman's creator, Bob Kane, was obsessed with Zorro as a kid growing up in Brooklyn.
So he said that it was very easy for him to take this character who had been in Southern California and put him in this megalopolis. And instead of the cave in the hills of California, he put him in a bat cave, made him a bat instead of a fox, and off he went to defend the oppressed.
But, you know, as time has gone on and the Zorro myth has developed, he's become a sort of epitome, a kind of the all-American hero.
Historian Felipe Fernandez Armesto.
And I think that, you know, just about every fictional masked hero in American literature derives from Zorro, you know, Batman, even Superman.
Felipe says you see Zorro's mark in others, the Lone Ranger, Spider-Man, and so on.
They all have the same characteristics. You know, they're all these loners on the outskirts of society who don't need society but who serve it. They all wear a mask to suppress their identity and identify themselves with universal values of right and justice.
But it's worth pointing out that the rakish individualists that Zorro was likely patterned after, they weren't American patriots. In fact, they fought against Americans.
So what a great irony that is, you know, that the great American hero tradition begins with someone who's actually a hero of resistance against the United States.
We often talk about patriotism and loyalty as prime American values. But you wouldn't guess it looking at our superheroes. Compassion for the weak and the will to question and confront authority. Now that's the stuff an all-American superhero is made of.
Out of the night when the full moon is bright, comes a horseman known as Zorro.
Our producer Marlon Bishop with the story of Zorro.
A scene is
So to wrap up our show, the best of the best of the past year of Latino USA is an hour-long show. I'm joined by producer Daisy Rosario, who brought us one of the funniest pieces we aired this year. So, hey, Daisy.
Hey, Maria.
All right. So why did you love this piece and how did you come upon it?
Well, I love Michelle Carlo. So she is a writer. She is a storyteller. She's someone I've seen around town. I met her through The Moth, which is a place that I've performed myself. I saw her there, and she was admittedly one of the few Latinas that I would see at Moth shows. And that kind of got us to chatting. So when we were kind of coming up with the idea for a Christmas show and knowing, let's get a fun story in there, let's find somebody with something a little different, something very holiday heavy, we started reaching out to a few people, and Michelle was one of the first people I thought of.
What was it? What is it about Michelle that makes you laugh?
She has such a wonderful perspective on her family. And if you have not visited our website and seen a picture of her, she is a Latina from the Bronx who has legitimately red hair. So she grew up being picked on for having red hair, for looking so different than her family, which I can relate to in many ways. And I think anyone who doesn't fit certain stereotypes as a Latino will often face those issues as well. But she has such a great perspective on it and just really can make fun of herself and is very proud of her family at the same time. Trying to share the things you love with your family, you know, she gets that odd dynamic and is happy to play it out. But there's always that clear love there at the core, which I think is what you really do want to hear as well.
All right, let's take a listen to Michelle Carlo.
Christmas Day, 2007. It's been a year of too many anniversaries. 10 years since my father died, 3 years since my 14-year marriage broke up, and 6 months since both my elderly cats had to be put to sleep. And I'm in my living room with my mother and brother after dinner, trying to watch The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, on a brand new DVD. Now, my mom was known as the Jackie O of East 103rd Street. She came to New York City from Puerto Rico when she was 6, and her normal speaking voice is like Jackie O. It's breathy and well-modulated, and she has absolutely no Latin accent whatsoever. But when she annoys me, like she is about to do right now, she sounds to me like the love child of Charo and Rosie Perez. Oye, mira, who is the white wizard? Gandalf, Mom? Well, you know, he's kind of like God. Well, maybe one of God's angels. Oh, and the red eye. What is that? You mean Sauron? Well, he's the devil. Well, maybe not really, like, maybe more like his emissary? You know, like he was sent by the devil to take over the Earth. Well, Middle Earth. Oh, and the one with the ring. Is he gay? In real life, Mom? Well, I think maybe Gandalf and Pippin are, but I don't think Frodo is. Now, every time I have tried to watch any kind of TV or movie with any member of my family, it's like an episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000, only Latino style. You talk during the show and take a break only during the commercials. Except that we were trying to watch a DVD, which means that they aren't any. And my brother just rewound it for the fifth time in an attempt to watch the Battle of the Pelennor Field scene once, just once, without interruption. What a hobbit? Hobbits, Mom. Little people. Oh, like dwarf? No, Mom. Gimli is the dwarf. Oh, which one is he? No. The elf? That's Legolas. It's the dwarf's friend. Oh, are they gay? Now, my mom is not and has never been dumb. And she is not and has never been homophobic. But she has, however, been obsessed with any gay movie and TV character of all time ever since one of her favorite actors of all time, Rock Hudson, had to leave her favorite TV show of all time, Dynasty. I remembered another TV watching long ago. Let's travel back to the Wayback Machine to 1985. Michelle, I hear Rock Hudson is not coming back to Dynasty. No, Mom, he's not. It's sad. He's gonna die. He has AIDS. No. He does not have AIDS. He has a cold. Mom, no, he doesn't have a cold. He has AIDS. He's gay. He is not gay. I saw him kiss Linda Evans last week, and he almost married Doris Day, too. Mom, that was in 1950. It's 1985 now. He's married to Jim Nabors. Jim Nabors?
You mean Gomer Pyle? Yes, Mom. Rock Hudson married Gomer Pyle. They are gay. G-A-Y. Y-M-C-A. They're gay. 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 You know, the problem with you, Michelle, is you believe everything you read. Well, my mother doesn't believe anything she reads or sees or hears. If it contradicts what she believes to be the orderly state of the universe, then it doesn't exist. Only her universe left off in 1957 when she left accounts receivable at Gimbel's to marry my father. We rewind the DVD yet again. Michelle, Michelle, those big elephants, are they supposed to be mastodons? Well, kind of, Mom, but not really. They're imaginary creatures. Oh, and the people riding on top of them with all the makeup, they're supposed to be from the Middle East, huh? Well, no, Mom, that kind of, but no, not really. They're allegorical. My mother gets this gleam of understanding in her eye, and I think, yes, oh, yes, she finally gets it. But instead, she turns to the TV and she goes, Allah? So they're Osama bin Laden? Get them, Gandalf! Get them! Slay them with your white light! As I watch my mom yelling at the TV, totally animated and into it, I have to think, this is what being a family means. Everybody has their blind spot. And you just have to take people for who they are, because you love them. By the time the Return of the King is over, I'm just totally exhausted. My brother is comatose, lying on the floor. But my mother is energized, sparkling, beautiful. She turns to me with her eyes bright, and she tells me how great the movie was and how she wanted to read the books now. And you know, Michelle, I know. Oh, no, she's talking normal now. She doesn't have the accent anymore because she's not annoying me. You know, Michelle, I know how much you loved to read those books when you were a kid and when you were young. I want to read them now. And I get excited by this, and I tell her that I think that Tolkien is one of the greatest writers of all time. And I start to tell her how he and the poet C.S. Lewis were great friends and how they each put a lot of their Catholic beliefs in their writings. But she interrupts me to ask, are they gay? I can't wait to take my mom to see The Hobbit Part 2. Merry Christmas.
Michelle Carlo is a native New Yorkerican and the author of Fish Out of Agua, My Life on Neither Side of the Subway Tracks.